Hello and welcome to the Hardcore Finance Podcast with Alex and Shimon. Today we're going to talk about bubbles. Fun bubbles, big bubbles, popping bubbles, and if we're really in a bubble. And if we are, what to do about it. Hey Shimon, how are you?
I'm very good. How are you, Alex?
I'm good. I feel very bubbly today.
Oh yeah, lots of people on Twitter saying that everything is in a bubble, and the bubble will get even more inflated with the stimulus package. So, what do you think of that?
I mean, look, not just Twitter, and I've been thinking a lot about it actually over the last couple of weeks. Last time you and I talked, we said, look, 2021, it's going to go up, up, and up, and there are some signs. It's a very weird time. Like the VIX, the volatility index is fine, but some other signs are just showing complete overheat in the market. And so I don't know what to do or how to think about it. And not just in the regular market, in the, you know, crypto and Bitcoin markets as well. So, you know, I'll give you some evidence about why I think we're overheated and what does it mean. Mm-hmm. And, but I know that you don't believe we're in a bubble. So maybe let's start there. You know, do you believe we're in a bubble, and are bubbles even bad?
Yeah, so I mean, we've spoken several times in the past about, I think it really depends on how you define a bubble. So for me, if you define a bubble by, oh, the market's going to crash by 50%, you know, next week, but then 1 month later, it will be back to all-time highs, I don't define this as a bubble. And that's just a definition, right? That's the definition of how I use the word. For me, a bubble is something that's like unsustainable. And once it pops, it doesn't go back to where it was, or it takes it a very long time to recover. So for example, you gave me the example of the, I don't remember, the S&P 500, I think, in 2008, right? So it took like 7 years for it to recover to its previous all-time high. And so we could claim that that was a bubble, right? That was like the real estate bubble that crashed the economy in 2008. And the reason why it's a bubble is because it took it 7 years to recover. Now, you look at the price of Amazon in 2008, and you and I were talking about this privately. So the price of Amazon also crashed and also took a long time to recover. But the price of Amazon in 2006, even after the crash of 2008, the price of Amazon went back to where it was in 2006. So in my definition, Amazon was not in a bubble, and the stock market as a whole was in a bubble. So basically, Amazon recovered much faster or didn't drop as much. And yeah, that's my definition of a bubble. And if that's the definition we're using, I definitely do not think that we're in a bubble. And I'm happy to tell you more about why. But what do you think about that definition? Or do you have any other thoughts of what a bubble is?
I don't agree with that definition, because implicitly you're saying that you have the benefit of longevity, of time. So even if something does crash, you're okay with it because it's going to crash on a short-term time horizon, and you're thinking, or you're in it on a longer term, which is fine and I think is right, and this is where I am as well. But maybe people aren't there. Maybe for someone that's looking to retire at the end of 2021, a crash in 2021 is a big deal, right? And so then we should think about whether there are bubbles or not, and whether things are overheated or not, and what does it mean? And I think that, you know, I'm beginning to worry a little bit. There's a couple of things that kind of worry me. One is this, you know, we're going higher and higher and higher in the market. And we both agree that it's largely because of some of the stimulus packages that money is being printed, and it literally has nowhere to go. This liquidity is trying to find a home, and it's flowing in every which way it can into real estate, into the market, into Bitcoin. So this means, right, that the only way that these valuations can be correct is if we come out of the pandemic kind of swinging, right? The recovery, the growth is there. The only thing that can basically, we talked about PE ratios and how they're not a perfect or even sometimes a good metric of the market, but let's just take it, you know, for what it is. In order for the PE ratios to be validated, or in order for a lot of the tech companies to be validated, to have a certain market cap without a corresponding profit is if we hit growth once we come out of the pandemic. And that's a big if, right? That's a big if. It's some of the signs are pointing there, but we do know we have this K-shaped recovery where, you know, the top is recovering well, but the people at the bottom aren't. And so that is what worries me. The other thing that worries me, honestly, is...
So one second. Before we move to another thing, I want to dig deeper into this. So first of all, does that worry you? Like, how do you make the link? Because I agree with you fully about what you said. If you're about to retire in like 6 months, you know, a 50% drop in the stock market could be very painful. It's just not what I define as a bubble. Like, I actually have no way of knowing whether the market will fall in the next couple of months by 50%. So when I'm talking about a bubble is, again, something that is some structural mispricing of the market that at some point people understand that it is mispriced, and then we'll have a repricing, and then it'll take a very long time for it to recover. So what do you think the K-shaped recovery and everything that you mentioned before, how does that lead to a bubble, or like what is mispriced about the market in your eyes?
Well, the fact that liquidity is going to the market, right? It's not that I think it's mispriced per se. What I actually think is, this summer is going to be the moment of truth. It's going to be the moment of truth among three prongs. One, will the pandemic subside? Two, will the vaccines work to stop the spread, not just the mm-hmm. The word just left me, but not just the symptoms. There we go. And three is, will we be able to return to life in a semblance of the previous way? Mm-hmm. And let me actually break down three into two parts. But before I do that, let me close the circle, because I want to get your thoughts on this. If these three things happen, then we hit the growth that we had before, and then we're not in a bubble, because the stock market now is building in expectations that that's what's going to happen. Mm-hmm. If we don't hit those three things, then I think we will be in a bubble, because expectations, the current prices, have largely outpaced what's going to happen. And I think mm-hmm. Here's what I want to get your thoughts. For me, and this is what I've been thinking about a lot, and it's an interesting mental exercise to do, is a lot of it, again, the crux is on growth, right? And the crux is to say that when the vaccines are rolled out and the pandemic subsides, or maybe it becomes an endemic, right? But when the summer comes, we should come back to our previous life. But my question is, maybe we don't come back to the previous life, and that's okay. Maybe because of the COVID has made us change our ways. So maybe restaurants will be a smaller part of the GDP, right? But virtual meetings and tech will be a bigger part of GDP, for example, and that will create more jobs. The jobs will just shift and the economy won't suffer. Or let's say restaurants will be able to shift their business models into doing more carryout and more delivery. And that's okay, because you have less people dining, you know, but you still have, you know, the jobs are repurposed for something else and people are carrying out food. So I don't necessarily think we need to return exactly to the way we were before.
I agree.
But as long as the economy is working at the same level as it was before.
And first of all, I think that's kind of the likely outcome. So I think not only are we going to return to the previous output, and yeah, even if the sectors shift, I mean, I was hearing like Bill Gates in an interview with Kara Swisher, and he said, I've met more African leaders on Zoom than I've met African leaders when I was willing to fly over and meet them there. So I think we unlocked a lot of efficiencies during this this time, where when we get rid of the restrictions, actually the economy may be more efficient than it was before COVID after an adjustment time. So I kind of agree with you. And by the way, let me just say, I agree with you that if like those things that you mentioned don't happen, we're going to be in a lot of trouble. I guess I'm just optimistic that they will happen. I think the vaccine works. I mean, there's data coming out of Israel showing that like after you get the vaccine, you just don't go to the hospital anymore. And then the idea that we'll, you know, the economy will return to where it was, I think it will happen by mid next year. So I don't think that's, when people say the stock market is in a bubble, I don't think they definitely mean this, or at least the Steelman argument of the stock market is in a bubble is that even if everything plays out with COVID in an optimistic way, the valuations are currently not sustainable. Like the price to earnings ratio is too high. We can't get growth. Like those are kind of the Steelman arguments. And that's what I kind of disagree with. But I fully agree with you that, like, yeah, if the vaccine doesn't work or if any of that stuff happens, we are in deep trouble.
So maybe it's interesting to look at industry by industry, because restaurants can definitely shift their business models. You know, some small mom and pop won't survive. But frankly, you know, it's people's lives and livelihoods, and I totally appreciate that and get it. But we do have some sort of ratio of zombie companies that are just meandering by. And in general, these kind of shakeouts in the economy shake out the weak hands, the weak businesses. As much as we don't like to see people suffer, none of us do. But this is the natural ebb and flow of a healthy economy that shakes out, you know, some of the deadwood or some of the zombie companies. What I think is going to be tougher, right, is, for example, or it'll be interesting to see how travel changes. So a lot of travel before, the premium on travel, the margin of what these guys made a lot of margin and the profits was on business travel, because there was no price elasticity there. You know, you're going to pay a ticket to go from Chicago to Houston because you need to go on a visit, and you're going to pay, you know, $700 for the same ticket as coach is paying, you know, $150 a round trip. And so if business travel fundamentally changes, which I think you believe it and I believe it, mm-hmm. right? We're going to travel mm-hmm. a lot less. Like I remember my previous job, I was in New York every 2 weeks, if not more often. And, you know, I would be on the Amtrak train. It didn't matter how much the tickets were. I'd be, you know, every 2 weeks I would go. That's not going to happen anytime soon. And so what about like travel and transportation infrastructure industries? How will they be able to structurally survive? Because I believe the business demand will probably fall by 50%.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if they will survive. I think, I I'm less interested in specific sectors when talking about a bubble, because I think that definitely there are some sectors that are overpriced. And like, I don't know, yeah, I've been hearing some of my friends say commercial real estate will never go back to its previous levels. Like, yeah, maybe it won't. Because it's hard to predict. Like, for example, Uber is a great example how like their Uber Eats business grew fantastically during COVID. And then, yeah, they had a sharp revenue decline from the rides business. But then you can imagine that after COVID, the rides business will go back to where it was before, like, you know, because Uber is usually like within the city. So I think, you know, it's not so much business travel. It's, you know, within the city. And then the Uber Eats will still stay stronger. So that's an example of it falls within transportation, but I don't know if they'll be hurt or not. Probably air travel will suffer. Although even that, like, yeah, I think air travel will suffer probably. Unless they somehow, the airlines balance it with delivering more packages like for Amazon or something. It's hard for me to see how they recover.
That's interesting. I think they're definitely going to shift towards, you know, towards just regular individual travel, personal travel, if you will. A lot of people are going to come out. I think there's going to be a lot of pent-up demand to spend in the summer. People haven't spent. I actually think that I'm a little bit nervous about some of the like at-home phenomenon that have grown in the pandemic, the Pelotons of the world, the at-home exercising. I think it's going to drop if people are able to actually go outside. And so I'm a little bit less bullish on those. And I know you said, let's not pick industries, but actually I think this is the crux, because there's some industries that have ripple effects onto others. For example, transportation. I think transportation is a major, major industry that has much and many ripple effects for elsewhere. So I'll give you an example. If commercial or business travel doesn't come back, call it 50% cut, right? That, again, it's a major margin hit, which means that de facto airlines will have to raise prices, which means that prices of consumer travel are going to increase substantially across the board. You won't be able to have this, or the airlines will go under. And if consumer travel has increased, right, that means either less people are going to be able to travel, even if they want to, or they have to find other means of travel. So I think, you know, the way it's actually going to shift is local travel. You're going to have more kind of car, RV, camping, more outdoorsy local travel. So if I'm making any kind of bets, I would actually bet on your like local campgrounds, those conglomerates that own campgrounds, conglomerates that own RVs, conglomerates that own outdoorsy kind of adventure, getaway, weekend travel versus cross-country travel. I think that's going to be a fundamental shift in the way Americans spend it and move. And it's, I think from an investing point of view, you and I, you know, you are more index, I'm more companies, but for our listeners that are actually looking at industries, you know, you kind of have to think two or three or four orders or steps down the line, that if business travel gets cut, air tickets have to increase or train tickets have to increase, less people will be able to afford that. So they're going to stay around the house, but people still want to get out. So there's going to be a lot of local tourism that's going to spawn around cities and the immediate like outdoor areas around the major cities in the US.
Yeah. Although I just have to say, so first of all, I agree with like to think of the second order effects of things for sure. And I think RV companies have been doing phenomenally well during the pandemic in terms of stock prices. I heard a podcast about that, but I just want to take, a pet peeve of mine, something that you mentioned, which I completely, completely disagree with, which I don't understand. And I hear it in the media a lot. So you said, for example, okay, less business travel will happen. And then the companies will have to raise prices. And that's like, I absolutely don't see any connection there. Like, yes, companies can go bankrupt. But like, when we think about it from a first principles perspective, like if you fly, you know, if you reduce your number of planes in a company and you only like have a smaller fleet, for example, of planes, and then you space things out, instead of having like 7 flights per day, you have like 1 flight per day. Nothing inherently has changed in the profitability of a new company doing that. Like, yes, if you have like debts or you have like employees or some other thing, yeah, you can go bankrupt. But I don't think that long-term all of these changes will change the profitability of the air travel industry, for example. I see the current companies being in trouble. But yeah, that's why I don't like to pick stocks, because it's so hard to know like what a company will decide to do. And maybe sometimes the difference between a company, you know, being very successful or like going bankrupt is just management. It's not the inherent business model or the, you know, competitive forces, or it's just like, you know, do managers make the right decisions? But yeah, that's, I guess, just why I don't like to pick specific companies.
So I completely disagree with you, and I'll tell you why, which is good that we're disagreeing. But first, mm-hmm. Why is that a pet peeve of yours?
Oh, it's just a pet peeve because, like, for example, when people say, oh, no, you know, the small businesses that got shut down on COVID will never recover. It's like, no, like a small business is just like a lease on some real estate plus some operation inside that does something with the real estate and sells something to people, whether it's a restaurant or whether it's... So you could say restaurants, for example, would not exist because people will eat less out. That I could understand. But when people say small businesses will never recover, it's like, no, I'm sorry. Like, even if all the small businesses go bankrupt, other entrepreneurs will come, will lease that commercial real estate. And okay, if there's less demand for commercial real estate, they'll convert some of this commercial real estate to residential real estate. And like over time, there's nothing inherent about from first principles that, you know, small businesses should go bankrupt. And you just hear it so much in the news. They just assume that the rents, for example, will not go down. Like, of course, rents will go down, you know, if like half of the businesses in town like fail. The rents for commercial real estate will go down. So then new entrepreneurs will come. And so, I mean, basically, yeah, that's how you get out of a recession. Like if what people said was true, that that businesses never recover, we would never get out of recessions. Like you could see something like 2008, the stock market would crash by 70% and then stay down. But no, the fact is people recover and, you know, capital finds more efficient uses. So that's why it's a peeve of mine.
Yeah, look, I agree with that. But here's why. Let's go back to airlines, for example, because it's not small businesses. Yeah, small businesses, a whole is clickbait in the media. But airlines, the major airlines, you can't just cut back planes, although it seems like that's the right solution.
Why? Maybe I'm not.
Yeah. I'll tell you why.
I'm not an expert, so maybe I don't know something.
Because, and let's look this up, but I'm 99% sure the big guys have to have some routes in order to, like, they have to fly to whatever city in the middle of nowhere. So in order to have those routes, you need to have the preceding routes beforehand.
What do you mean by have to?
They're obligated by the government.
Okay, yeah. So the government has to change regulation.
No.
I'm not saying like all else equal. Of course, many things will have to change.
But that's not the way it works. People have to be fired. But that's not the way it works, because then just like U.S. mail, U.S. mail has to be delivered to, you know, small town Alaska, and it costs the same stamp that it costs for me to ship it from, you know, a suburb of LA to the city of LA, right? Yeah. Same 10-minute drive costs me the same to ship from Miami to Alaska, right? Yeah. So the airlines have to have this in order for people to get serviced with transportation. Then they have to create point-to-point. This is, by the way, why Southwest was able to outcompete United and American, because Southwest is a challenger. Didn't have to do this, where the major international airlines that are domestic, you know, operate in the U.S. do. And so you can't...
The thing is that because of regulation, the ticket prices will have to go up, and then what, will they go bankrupt? Like, would they go bankrupt because the ticket prices go up, or do you think people just pay the higher prices? Like, how does your scenario play out?
No, they just have to...
Let's say the regulation doesn't...
increase in prices.
So, and then like an entrepreneur can't come and offer lower prices to compete with them because they want them like not fly to the small places. Like my point is like what you're describing is basically you're saying tickets will go up because of regulation, not tickets will go up because of the pandemic. You know what I mean?
But the regulation has been there for, look, the whole point of regulation, just like there's regulation. See, you can't completely operate in a world of no, there's regulation to get certain infrastructure services to people in rural areas across the board, in cable, in internet, in transportation, in mail, in, you know, airlines, in energy, in many places. You have the government fees in order to get to the kind of last mile. So same thing, for example, cable companies, internet companies, they have to build certain towers that are not at all profitable for them, but so you can wire, you know, Jane and Joe who live in the middle of the country so they can have access to telecommunications, which, by the way, is good for everyone. For telecom, it's good because the biggest thing to improve GDP and productivity is to be able to connect connectivity. That's telecom. And there are many studies, but there are also many studies for transportation.
I'm not arguing against it. So I'm not saying it's a bad thing. I'm just saying, okay, like, by the way, that's why it's nice how many of the topics we discussed go back to themes. Remember the episode where I said that I'd rather invest in industries that are less exposed to regulation and industries that are more flexible? So this is exactly my point, because what you describe are industries that are not fully private. They're like some percent of them private, but some percent is kind of nationalized, right? Because like you need a license from the government. So it means that the government can like control some of your decisions. And that might be okay. Like it might be actually a good thing for prosperity, even though I think that the private market can do it better, but that's another discussion. But even within these constraints, I would just say I would not put my money in these companies because, to your point, yes, they'll be less efficiently able to recover from the pandemic. And yeah, maybe I should find an ETF that like invests in all of these things and short it, because compared to the market, that's exactly the issue that I don't like, when it's like the government, for example, you know, with the small businesses. Yeah, I'll tell you a scenario under which small businesses will not recover from the pandemic is like with a $15 minimum wage. So there, yes, maybe because the minimum wage is $15, even though your rent price went down, you need like two employees, and like what you are able to sell is not profitable enough to pay those two employees. And then basically the business never recovers. That's exactly my point for why regulation, it could be good, although I really don't think it's good in the vast majority of cases, but it definitely slows down economic recovery.
Yeah, sure. I totally agree with you, but that's what I'm saying. Like given the rules of the game, that we have. Nothing's going to change in the next few months for the government to say, no, it's okay, you don't apply there. And by the way, even if there wasn't a government regulation, you know, airlines, you have to operate on marginal cost here. So the fixed cost of a flight, and they work point to point, right? It's like hub and spoke, and then they go from one city to another to another. So that's why, for example, you know, Skiplag, Google bought them, the website where you can get cheap tickets. If you buy, let's say I want to fly Chicago to DC, and instead I choose a route that's like Chicago to Charleston, South Carolina, flying through DC. That's a cheaper ticket than Chicago to DC. Why? Because they need to fulfill the leg from DC to Charleston. They are going to fly there anyway. And so to induce me to go there, the ticket Chicago to DC is cheaper. So the airlines can't change that structurally. We actually have, I have some good friends that work in airlines. Maybe we should, you know, maybe it'll be an interesting topic for a different time, but I don't think they can just up and, they will of course curb flights, but not all flights. You will have some flights that are empty, and flights that are full are going to have less business customers.
I agree with business customers for sure. That's a sector that's going to be massively diminished just because people understand that it's not fun. And so if once we figure out that we can be productive without that activity, that's not fun. It's just not coming back. It's like saying, the market for like dentists that don't know how to use anesthesia crashed and never recovered. Yeah, it's like, because once you have anesthesia, everybody wants to use it. But my point, that's why, like, I don't like betting on sectors. But my point, again, the steel man that I want to address is the steel man that says, like, everything, like, even if you look at, like, all the stock market combined, it's in a bubble territory and it's going to crash and not recover. Because also, to your point, I mean, even if airlines don't recover, Amazon more than made up for the decline in airlines, right? So if you're holding an index, the airline story shouldn't matter too much, right?
Yeah, but if you're investing, but again, the point is, will in the summer, will our economy actually catch up to the expectations? And, you know, if Amazon can directly substitute the jobs of all the airline workers that are no longer working in this mm-hmm. example, then we're okay. Right. Yeah. If they cannot, because they're doing things more efficiently and you have more workers out of a job, then we're not. And I think that's because the US economy, which is good, is driven by consumption. By the way, you know, as an aside, you know, we talk about, or there are a lot of times it's talked about, you know, will China ever take over in terms of like a global reserve currency? And I listened to a good podcast a couple of days ago, and they were talking about, you know, the Chinese economy is driven by production of the government. And, you know, there's a lot of talks about Chinese ghost cities. You know, they build a city, no one's there. Literally, it's a brand new, amazing city, skyscrapers, and no one, literally not a soul is there because they're just building to build. And I say this as a foil to the US economy, which is driven by consumerism, by consumption, which is good, which is what ultimately a capitalistic economy should be driven by. But the point here is that if not all of these jobs are replaced, or not really jobs, but consumption, right? If the amount of consumption isn't replaced by shifting jobs from an industry that's dying because of COVID to an industry that's blossoming because of COVID, then we're in trouble. So I don't know if, you know, let's say 1,000 airline workers lose their jobs on a macro scale, and Amazon can only hire 500 of those 1,000, but they're giving them, you know, higher wages, and they are able to earn more in order to compensate for the exact same or more spending power that the previous 1,000 had, then we're okay. If that doesn't happen, then we're not. And it will be interesting to see, to think about, right, like which industries, how they're going to shift. Again, to me, the industries matter. I know to you, the whole market matters. But for me, it's interesting to see what are the shifts and what to look out for, right, to not just these macro views of the index has gone up or more trading is happening than ever before, or the, you know, the volatility is decreasing or increasing, but to see micro like alarm bells. Will we have any kind of, you know, sounds of alarm where one industry is severely underperforming or vice versa, overperforming than what we thought?
Yeah, I don't think we will. I don't think we will, because I just inherently think it's really hard to predict those things and to see signs of alarm. But again, what I would argue is that for investors who do not care about a you know, 5-6 month or 1 year time horizon, my case is that the market is not in a bubble, and yeah, it's and I'm happy to make that case, but like I definitely cannot make the case of, you know, how will we know if something is about to crash or like which industries will crash? I think those are kind of very tricky things, especially because like you have to figure out what is priced in versus what is not priced in. Like the whole story you said about the airlines, it might play out exactly, you know, the way you describe it. But then the question is how many investors have already thought about it and priced it in. And that's even more tricky than figuring out what will happen. So the only thing I wanted to comment on in terms of the bubble is just the market as a whole. And like why I think that we're not in a bubble. It's literally answering the question. You know, so many people are asking me, like my parents, my family, it's like, oh, the stock market is all time high. Is now a good time like to put money in the stock market or should I just wait? So like I can answer that question. I cannot answer the question of like, should I put the money in the stock market or in real estate? Like I literally do not know. I do not know what will go up faster. But I can definitely answer, should you wait for a crash?
What's the answer?
Okay, so my answer basically is very simple. So I doodled a little bit with a PE ratio. So the PE ratio of the stock market is definitely very, very high. It's I don't know if it's been highest. It's currently the prediction for 2021 is like a PE of 40. It only was wow. Higher than this in 2002. We were on 46. And then in 2009, we were at a 70 because of the just before the crash and stuff. But like otherwise, it's very, very hard to find. And historically, the average has been something like 15. So I think that's what makes people nervous, which is like we're way, way above historical territory, which means that you're paying for 40 years of revenues when you're buying an average stock in the S&P 500. And it's not tech. I'm talking about the S&P 500. I bet NASDAQ would be even higher. And so that's what makes people really nervous. They're like, okay, it's kind of crazy for me to pay some money now and have to make 40 years of current revenues. And my answer to that is because I drew a 30-year moving average of PE ratios to neutralize a little bit of the noise. And it's just a trend that's going up.
Yes, I was going to mention exactly this.
So in 1875, the PE ratio of the S&P 500 was around 10, according to the data I have. I have data here from a website called Multiple, without the E at the end, multiple.com. But anyway, even if the data is like not
multiple,
it's directional. Yeah, multiple. So it was 10, right? And then by 1975, it was like 15. And then in 2000, it became like 20, and then we actually crossed 20 and never came down. So it's a really interesting thing. When you draw the 30-year average, the PE has been going up steadily since like 1998, more or less. Now, what happened in 1998? In 1998, consumer computers became very, very prevalent, and like everybody was connected to the internet. And so my claim is that you can draw basically two lines, and I wish I could share this. I'll put it on Twitter to share this chart because it's a very interesting chart. It's almost like you have
I
like
think our audience. But sorry, by the way, I think our audience needs to close their eyes, imagine a 2x2, and let Shimon guide you through a world of financial meditation.
So it's actually a fascinating thing now that I'm blowing it up. So basically, we had three areas of growth of the PE ratio, 30-year average. The first area that I'm seeing here is from like 1875 all the way to 1922, more or less, where it grows really, really sharply. So it went like from 10 to around 15, right? Then it crashed because of the big 1929 recession. And then there was a period from around 1925 to 1998, so most of the 20th century, at which it was growing relatively slowly. So in 1925, it was around, like, call it 13. And by 1998, the PE was around 15. So very, very slow growth. And then from 1998 till today, it's just a straight line up. It went like from around 15 to like 25 currently. and again, 25, I'm talking about a 30-year average of the price-to-earnings ratio. So you kind of neutralize recessions and this and that. It's just like a moving average. And what does this data tell us? We caught, before the 20th century, we caught the tail end of the Industrial Revolution, where there was like a technology that was creating a tremendous amount of growth, right? Then there was like a depression, world wars, whatever. We spoke about that in our episode for the Roaring 20s. In the 20th century, when people say, oh my God, like it was amazing, like the technology developed in the 20th century. So no, we actually did not develop the technology too much because it only grew a little bit, the price to earnings. A little double click here. Why is technology affecting price to earnings ratio? Because when you say I have a business, right, and it creates a steady stream of cash flow, you can grow that business by selling your stuff to more and more people, but that's kind of limited, right? But if you have a technology, it can reduce your cost by a lot. Like imagine a factory that works on coal and then it becomes like an electrical factory, right, producing the same stuff. It's a huge, huge, huge change in the profitability, right? So that's why basically technology makes price to earnings ratio be higher, because you're saying I'm willing to get more years of downstream revenue because I know it will take a while, but like once it picks up, the earnings will grow up like crazy. So you think of a company like Google or Amazon or Netflix, it's like you're happy to pay 40 years of earnings because like you're saying, oh no, like it will actually keep growing by a very, very high rate. And so it's 40 years of today's earnings. But if you take into account the earnings growth, I'll make my money in 10 years maybe. And then after that, it's all profit. So that's the general thesis that we are only now starting to see the economical impact of the internet revolution. And, you know, Bitcoin is part of it. You could say that Bitcoin is part of the internet. It's just like the money layer of the internet. So that is my thesis on the Steelman argument of like why the stock market is not in a bubble. Again, without saying anything about what will happen in the next 6 months, but just like the very long-term trend.
So I love that you brought this up because it's actually a fascinating, fascinating piece of insight. And very many people don't know about this, unfortunately. But you're right. If you actually normalize PE ratios, because it has been growing over time, there's one other part I want to add, two other parts. One is, after the Great Depression, we've implemented new accounting rules and basically visibility rules into the business. And so when you think about a P/E ratio, forget like tech for a second, but you're thinking about a P/E ratio of a company. Investors, more often than not, like something that's more transparent then less transparent, something that's more predictable, then less predictable. And I know boring accounting rules, blah, 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 but it actually makes a lot of sense because as time has gone, right, once we implemented these rules, companies have become more open with their books, more open in terms of how they report, more open with the strategies. And so investors are able to allow them to make up what's a P ratio, how many years will it take of the company's profits to equal basically the stock price or the dividends to equal the stock price, right? So you're giving them more leeway because they're more transparent with you. That's where you have a slow growth. And afterwards, I totally agree with you on technology. Not only what you said, but also tech helps you scale and it helps you reach markets. So it's a downward pressure on price, on the cost of, you know, creating or producing whatever it is that you're producing. And it's an accelerator and scale. And I think a third thing that very few people talk about is that as tech, especially in the internet era, has made it much easier to monetize people. And because before you would buy a product as a consumer, right? So people fight for your share of wallet. Now we fight for your share of attention, for your share of eyeballs. So, which means that the whole time when you're at home, you used to be with the family, you used to have leisure. Maybe some people say that's not good because now we're glued to our phones, but it is what it is. And we found a way to monetize many other areas and parts of a person's life that were completely inaccessible to us before. So we're able to scale better. We're more transparent. we're able to monetize the consumer. We have more channels to get to monetization. And there is downward pressure on prices because it's more efficient to produce, which is what you said very, mm-hmm. very smartly. And so the PE ratios, I totally agree, as a general market rule, are going to keep on increasing. And that's absolutely okay. Absolutely okay.
Yeah, and I think that's what people miss, which is like they say, yeah, we've never seen things like these before. But then they don't ask, and that's, again, another pet peeve that I have with journalists. Like, why isn't the follow-up question, like, why haven't we had anything like this before, right? Like, they will say, like, oh, printing money, whatever. But, like, I'm sorry. Like, if printing money was, I mean, you know, I'm really against printing money and stuff. But if that was the answer, we would have crashed a long time ago, right? Like, if, so it's a very simplistic kind of analysis of you know, and again, I think we had this with the episode with Stefan. We've had this with chats between us. I actually think that the current money printing regime can continue for a very long time. And I don't see any reason for the governments to change it and stop printing money. So then the question is, okay, like, why do we get these crazy high PE ratios? And nobody's talking about technology in that way. It's really, really interesting.
This sounds like a tweet. We should tweet your chart, and we should tweet the fact that tech, it's you know, PE ratios are okay to increase. I think it's actually very powerful. It's a very powerful insight that people completely miss, like you said. You know, we're always very good about looking back at the past, and it's very important. But you're right. We don't ask why. We don't adjust for new business models. Because since the 2000s, right, since the internet bubble, And by the way, the internet bubble in and of itself was a very unique thing. There can always be a bubble, but the internet was such a new revolutionary technology that in the long run, it wasn't a bubble, right? It was very painful. It took 10 years to recover from it because there were many companies. Pets.com is a famous one. You know, Pets.com was just 10 years, 15 years too early, but it was a genius idea. So yeah, it was a sharp bubble, but it was a new paradigm of how we live our lives, right? And this is to bring it to Bitcoin. This is why Bitcoin and all of these other, you know, digital assets, yeah, they're in kind of a bubble in terms of a lot of these guys are going to crash to zero and go away, just like Pets.com did. But it doesn't mean that the whole idea isn't a completely revolutionary and paradigm shift of an idea, just like the internet was. You know, some big players would win. If you bet on Amazon or Microsoft or Google or I don't remember, even AOL back in the day, you would have been just fine. So betting on like a Bitcoin, for example, now, you're going to be just fine. Some of the other smaller players will come in, come out just because it's a radically new world, right? And it's going to cause a lot of heavy casualties as it matures, as it blossoms. But that's why, you know, like when people talk about, oh, the internet bubble. Yeah, the internet bubble, if you bet across an internet index, you would have been, you know, a very wealthy person now. 20 years, 30 years later, if you thought about a long-term horizon and you had that time, you would have been very wealthy, even with the mega crash of 80% or whatever it was. So, you know, it's interesting to put things into context. And the reason why I brought this up is I don't think in the general markets we're going to see another dot-com-like bubble because no industry is getting radically changed. Again, the only industry that's getting radically changed like this is the crypto markets, which we all know we're going to go through these ups and 80% corrections, and everyone that's in the market is okay with it. You know, so it's like that we're the place where it's going to happen. People are okay with it. In the general markets, I just don't think, I don't see it happening because nothing is changing as radically in the open kind of wide market. Do you foresee the dot-com bubble happening again?
No, I don't think so. I mean, look, I the dot-com bubble actually was less of a problem for me because that's, I think it was a bit short-lived. So like you said, right, you could have invested in tech, and as long as you didn't buy the absolute top, any tech index that you bought, like in 98, and then in 2000, it crashed, probably by 2001, you're okay already.
But even if you did buy the top, 10 years later,
even if you did buy the top, it just took you a bit longer to recover. And yeah, I definitely don't see anything like 2008 happening, just because I think the big learning in COVID was that the Fed really had its shit together in terms of just dumping tons of money on the system, because they learned. They learned from 2008. I mean, I remember I took this course, Money Markets and the Fed, with a guy who was, you know, working at the Fed at some point, and it was happening. The QE of like 2011 was happening. It was Operation Twist. And he was like, oh my God, there's so many jokes about Twist and Shout. Like, they really didn't know what's going to happen in 2011, right, as they were doing the QE. And I think they just learned. They got data. They understood the effect of that stuff on prices. And so now, if there's anything like the tech crash or some kind of like crash that's not too systemically problematic in terms of the economy, it will just the Fed will just dump a bunch of money on the market and it will recover even faster. And I think COVID was a plan that they just deployed, and it worked exactly as planned in March.
Are you for that? Are you? Do you agree with that? With that plan?
I mean, do you think? Are you asking me? Could I choose whether to do it or not do it? And what would I choose to do? I would choose to not do it. Because I think, you know, if I was like the supreme dictator of the world and had like no political constraints and I could do whatever, I would choose to not do it. Because then again, back to the airline example, like a bunch of companies would go bankrupt, a bunch of people would get laid off. And then as long as you allow the market to like really quickly adapt, so like no regulation in like crazy, like for example, no minimum wage, no like zoning laws, and you can just like repurpose the real estate or whatever crashes, that would be the ideal thing. If you say everything else is equal, but I can just decide whether to do it or not, I would say probably we should do it, because like the system is so inefficient currently. Like, actually, it's a really nice way to tie it back to how we started the episode. The airlines example was the perfect example, right? You gave a perfect example, which is like, you know, should we bail out the airlines now that COVID happened? It's like, well, yeah, all else equal, of course we should bail them out. But if we could like control everything and we were supreme dictators, you don't bail out the airlines. And then like the airplanes get sold to some startup that does other things with them. And then very quickly, entrepreneurs will come in and figure out the transportation problem of those remote places where it's no longer profitable or whatever, right? Like if you could let the market figure stuff out, I think everything would work much, much better. I don't think it's politically feasible, because like the unions and all of these people that have power, they can just like affect the decision. And also, I think politicians don't pay any political price for printing money. So why should they not do it? You know what I mean? It's like, there's no downside for them. And that's why I'm certain it will happen. But no, yeah, if I was the supreme dictator, I wouldn't do it.
First of all, I want to say for the record that if I was a supreme dictator, I would live in a house with what?
Nothing. I'm just laughing.
Oh, good. Well, it's important. If I was a supreme dictator, I would definitely live in a house with exactly two moats. One for the alligators, the other just for fun. It would be like a hidden moat. The drawbridge would always be down, but I would have two moats all the time. It's my dream, really. My dream, once upon a time in the future, this will happen.
That's but, awesome.
Yeah, you're more than welcome to come. Always.
Thank you.
I'll tell you where to cross where the alligators aren't. Maybe I agree with you on that. If we had the ability to just, if the government basically pointed and said, hey guys, look, this sector is suffering, you know, all good solutions, and there have to be some sort of incentive, like we'll subsidize, you know, whatever. Well, there's a certain prize or grant or government contract to win for all entrepreneurs to come, and the best idea wins, mm-hmm. right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. That'll
be, and the government just pays, allocates resources instead of actually managing and executing. Yeah, yeah, yeah. I mean, we should we should do not on this one, but I've always thought about this. Are there industries the government needs to control for, you know, strategic reasons and execute themselves versus outsource? We should do this episode because I think it's very interesting. I think you and I are going to disagree a lot, which is what I love. I think we've come to a good, you know, kind of stopping point, and we both, for different reasons, agree that we're not necessarily in a bubble. we agree that the summer is going to be the make it or break it for the US in terms of, will we see consumption peak? Will we see the same willingness to spend peak? Will we see consumerism come back? And I think we both agree that it's important to look at things in context and just for real business models. Like your point about P/E ratios, again, I want to underscore, because it's a very astute and smart point that many people miss, is that P/E ratios have been going up over time. And like you said, significantly past dot-com boom. And that's very, very, very important.
The beautiful thing, it's even more than that. It's not just over time. Like, you can really see the three paradigms of like the 19th century industrial revolution, then the 20th century when not too much happened, it was still going up, but it was going up less. And then the 21st century, the tech revolution, where it's skyrocketing. So I think it's just very interesting to think about it in terms of periods, right, and epochs. So even though it's going up over time. And by the way, one thing that I just wanted to say, I think the financial industry, right, will really benefit in the long run from Bitcoin. So that's an example of you know, what we said about the airlines. The financial industry almost doesn't have a choice, right? So with the airlines, you have a choice. It's like, oh, do you let them go bankrupt and then like have other entrepreneurs, you know, doing like more efficient ways of flying? Bitcoin is like aliens came with spaceships and they're like, look, dude, you can use my spaceship and it costs $1 from anywhere to anywhere in on planet Earth. Like, and we have these defenses where the army can't shoot down our spaceships, or you can use United Airlines. It's like everybody will go to the spaceships and United Airlines can't do anything about it. So that's how I look at Bitcoin, which is like it's forcing the financial industry to really, really restructure. But like after Bitcoin, and with Bitcoin as a base layer, it will be more efficient and it will be able to drive PE ratios higher in the financial industry. Like imagine, I'm just imagining financial, because again, I don't know too much about airplanes. I'm sure you can make the same argument about airlines, but imagine like a really smart loan officer that knows how to assess you based on your like resume and like your grades in high school or whatever, and give you like really good interest rates, you know, because like you're not going to default on your stuff. And then they become really, really good at that. And maybe there's some AI helping them. Like think of how many people are not getting credit currently because their credit scores are bad, even though whatever, we spoke about that, how inefficient the system is. So like anything in finance can be made much more efficient if we just had like the right technology, and Bitcoin is one of those. And I'm sure you can do this, you know, just apply technology to everything. Like ARK Invest, I heard a podcast with them. They were talking about the genetic revolution. It's like, we haven't even scratched the surface there, because it's basically, we know the code of life, but we don't know how to program it. But like, we know it. So it's like, now we just have to figure out how to program it.
Well, interesting. Right. Yeah. Interestingly, because of COVID brought up this innovation with Moderna specifically, right? And Pfizer, they are coding it through mRNA technologies. So it's just, you know, with every cloud and storm is a silver lining, and the silver lining for COVID has been finally we have breakthrough on a scale, breakthrough medical innovation that we haven't had in decades. And wow, there's so many episodes that we need to do after this. We need to do one in genetics. We need to do one on, you know, the future of tech innovation. We need to do one on governments and what's strategic or not. I mean, there's a lot of good stuff in here.
Yeah, I'm just very interested. I just want to leave our listeners with a philosophical thought. Like, to make money in investments, in any type of investments, I'm sure it's the same with real estate investments or bond investments, you have to believe something that most of the market does not believe, and also be right. Like, it's a very tricky thing, right? Because like the market is pretty smart. And so if you want to outperform the market, you have to like believe something that most people do not like believe, or it could be about the order of magnitude. So it could be like, that's what the ARK people said. They said, look, like we just think the tech trend is very underpriced. And like, that's their thesis, right? And they can back it up. So I don't know. I just say to our listeners, pick something, get to know it pretty well, and then you can be very good at investing in it, because you can figure out where everybody's like just not right about something.
Yep. On that note, guys, thank you for listening to us. HardcoreFinance.com. Please donate. Please subscribe to the podcast. Please leave reviews. We love hearing from you. Give us topics for the next go-round. I know a lot of you have told me personally that you love when Shimon and I disagree. So we'll try to disagree a little bit more. On the Stefan Levera episode, someone told me that at the end, Stefan had to separate us almost. The guests were separating the hosts, which is what I love. It shows the passion.
Maybe this can be a new podcast concept, is like we fight with each other and a guest is trying to calm us down.
I love it. I love it. Guest. No, Shimon, you're wrong. I love it. I love it. Well, thanks for listening to us, guys. Please leave reviews. Please donate. Let us know what you want to come out. And we'll talk to you guys soon.
Yeah, talk to you soon, Alex. It was a pleasure as always.